Hey everyone, welcome to My Yuppie Movie. This week we are talking about The Tragedy of Macbeth. Now, this is a crossover episode with one of my other podcasts, Required Reading. Usually it's something I do with Mike Burns, and we talk about, you know, the little things in books and that, like, we like, we don't like. The idea is that it would be books that we assign as teachers, we're both high school teachers, that we have, say, read in the past and would make a great fit, or ones that we had as students when we were in high school, and sometimes we say they should still be taught, sometimes they don't. It's just a kind of fun discussion of some books that, you know, maybe you haven't heard of, or maybe you still have that, you know, terrifying memory of having to learn it back in high school. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. And because the Joel Coen, Denzel Washington, Frances McDormand, Brendan Gleeson, excuse me, movie, The Tragedy of Macbeth, is up for a slew of Academy Awards and has already won several other awards, we thought it would be a good crossover to talk about both the movie and the book, play by William Shakespeare. So please enjoy, consider signing up, subscribing to Required Reading as well, and like this podcast, subscribe, and enjoy your bonus Academy Award episode. Thanks, guys. Welcome to Required Reading. This week, we're talking about Bill Shakespeare. I never heard of him. We're talking about Macbeth, the Tragedy of Macbeth, the forbidden play, the Scottish play, whatever you want to call it. We're not acting it, so we'll refer to it as the actual name. We're doing this, of course, in honor of what will be, probably by the end of the month this comes out, an Academy Award nominee, to one degree or another, The Tragedy of Macbeth, done by Joel Coen, starring Denzel Washington and everyone else, Frances McDormand, Donald Gleeson, one of the Dudleys from Harry Potter. Uh-huh. Anyway, incredible cast, incredible movie. We'll probably incorporate it because it's entering the lexicon again as an Academy Award-winning film. But tragically, Mike Burns didn't do his homework last night, so...
Outed.
Please. I'm sure he would do the same to me. What panel we have?
Mike Carroll.
And?
Betsy Holcomb.
Back again. I don't have to introduce anyone. Here our back catalog. You were here for Flannery O'Connor.
That's right.
And you've just been showing up every time.
Yeah, I've just been kind of coming by, you know. You can't get rid of me.
That's right. So if you want to hear him again, kids' books, and mm-hmm. you were also on your dissertation, Beowulf, as we went into Beowulf.
Yeah.
So I'm sure, first and foremost, we all know the play very well. We've done it before. Have you ever had to teach it?
I've never taught it. I've read it a couple of times. I've read it in high school, read it in college, read it in grad school. But I've never taught it.
Do you remember when you first learned it?
Yeah, I think it was my sophomore year of honors English for Mr. Klein. Shout out Mr. Klein up north in Boston.
That's funny. Here, where we teach, is where I went, so it's a very small world. Mm-hmm. But we used to do a Shakespeare play a year. I don't know if you still do. So I did it here. I believe I did it in Mary Beth Cox's classroom. But yeah, no, it's an incredible play that, you know, again, learned in the middle of high school. When did you do it?
Yeah, I remember in high school, and we were talking about earlier theater, and I remember they did it while I was a student, and I just remember the only thing that stuck with me was the Scottish accents. But then in college, I had the chance to be in it, and I was one of the witches, which was what I think was the beginning of me falling in love with the play. Mm-hmm. And then... at my last school, I taught it in a class that I created called Theology and the Arts. And so actually, I would kind of pair it up with Breaking Bad. And so
wow.
I would, it seems to me like such
a really cool
connection. So we would teach it, or I would teach it. We would learn it thematically. We would sort of delight in it. And then actually, I was able to take students a lot of times to Shakespeare Tavern here in Atlanta.
Nice.
And actually see it live, which was a gift. So yeah, it's my favorite. Is it your favorite Shakespeare?
So I teach Romeo and Juliet in eighth grade, and I think just because of how well I know it, and from teaching it the last 9 years, I think that's probably if it wasn't before, I think it has become my favorite play, Romeo and Juliet by Shakespeare. But I think maybe you were like at the table next to me when Macbeth was at Shakespeare Tavern at this point, gosh, it was probably like 6 years or so ago.
Yeah.
But I've seen Macbeth performed at Shakespeare Tavern, and holy cow, is it awesome.
Yeah.
It's really, really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, frankly, as far as my favorite, the one, and again, I know it's good. I can't do Romeo and Juliet because everyone does Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah.
And so for me, the fun things are the ones that aren't done as often.
Uh-huh.
I think of the, I guess, his genre, royal people do stupid things.
It's down to this in Hamlet. They're very close. Yeah. I like King Lear a lot. I like Richard III a lot. The Henrys I haven't actually ever seen. But probably my favorite are the comedies, and specifically the kind of fantasy comedies. I like Midsummer Night's Dream a lot. Yeah. I like The Tempest a lot.
The Tempest, yeah, for sure.
We don't study it as often. And so when I first studied it in a dystopia class, it was just incredible. Like, it's very funny. It's very weird.
Yeah.
So I kind of like his weird stuff more. But, like, this is just high drama. I love this play a lot. And I'm excited we actually get to talk about it. Especially since, again, referencing the movie, it's less than 2 hours.
Yeah.
It moves real quick.
So fast. Yeah. The dominoes are just falling from, like, the first 10 minutes.
And just in general, considering the language being distant by about 500 years almost, I understood it. You don't have to necessarily have, I mean, no offense, you don't have to have an English teacher take you through it. You get the high emotion, you get the plot progression, you're like, hey, that guy's wearing a fancy hat, oh no!
Yeah.
And it just moves, which I appreciate as well. So, you want to take us through the plot a little bit?
Yeah. So I think if you're okay with it, that I really liked the way that the play kind of opened up. So I think Nick, I had kind of mentioned this to you just in passing. Wanted to save it a little bit more for the podcast, but just the way that this particular production opened up, I found absolutely riveting. And it starts with this kind of like this scene and the lines of fair is foul and foul is fair. And so you kind of get the impression from the very beginning, specifically of this production, that things are going to be kind of like off kilter. Things are not going to be originally what it is that they seem. And so after they, correct me if I'm wrong, I think, but in the visual in this production, they have those letters and they're just in black and white. And then they kind of fade out and you kind of like open on this scene where you're looking at a bird, which we don't know at the time, but ends up being one of the ravens that are very visually and also thematically super present in the play. But you're looking at this raven, but you're far enough away that it almost looks like you're kind of like looking up at it through the mist and through the fog and through the clouds. And then as the fog starts to dissipate a little bit, you realize that you're not actually looking up at this bird. You're actually super high up and looking down. And then the fog kind of like clears out of the way. And what you thought was looking up, you're actually looking down. And then you can see kind of the human characters that are down below. And so I just thought that it was this awesome way of kind of opening into a play where things are not always what they seem, where just right there in the opening shot, you realize, wow, things in this are not going to be what it is that they seem.
Right. There's already these main elements of the play where, you know, we're not sure who's seeing what, who sees the dagger, who doesn't see the dagger, who sees the witches, who doesn't see the witches. But you're exactly right that as a film, they've added all these extra elements that continue that theme. I love that.
Yeah, really, really cool too, because I do feel like having seen different productions and different movie versions and different kind of adaptations of the play, I don't know about you guys, but I always find myself kind of like sitting on the edge of my seat as like a couple of moments come up just to be like, okay, what are they going to do with X, Y, Z?
Exactly.
You know, like what are they going to do with the dagger? Is there actually going to be a dagger?
Yeah.
What are they going to do with the ghost? Is there actually going to be a ghost?
Right.
What are they going to do with the witches? Are there going to be three? Because in this production, there's, well,
kind of
three with like a little bit of a reflection, you know?
Exactly.
So like it, coming up to those moments, I just find myself like on the edge of my seat, just kind of like waiting there for ooh, what are they going to do? And that's kind of what I really thought that in those moments, they were kind of playing with your anticipation of those and did some really cool stuff in those moments, I thought at least.
Well, and again, like, it's also hard to do Shakespeare because as a play, there's sometimes no reason for someone to walk in and out of the scene.
Right.
But they do a good job here. It's Scotland, so it's foggy all the time. And the fog hides everything. And so you have people like cresting hills, and then the scenery reveals itself. It's exactly the fog of war.
Right.
But we just have, like, we know as much as the king as Duncan does, as Duncan does it. And, you know, Donald Gleeson is just there looking like, oh good, it's my sign has returned.
Yeah.
It's so well done as we describe it. So
I think the choice to be in black and white was really stunning. And there were many instances throughout the entire film that I loved how they used shadow. Mm-hmm. I loved how it simplified things quite a bit for me. The whole, you know, design of, or what use of shadow, the use of a very just a simplistic set, mm-hmm. felt to me like it just only highlighted the beautiful text and the way that the actors brought it to life.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it is nice to kind of see the way they interpret it. Mm-hmm. These choices were, unique and surprising. And it was really great.
Sure.
I agree.
Well, and I mean, again, like what happens? You have first act, we do eventually have to talk about it.
Okay, so so we meet King Duncan and they're in war, and he hears that Macbeth is, well, I'm going to butcher the line, but slain someone like from the top to the bottom, right?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So that's really the first, I think, thing we learn about him, but we don't know much else. And we've got the witches right at the beginning, too. So we learn early on that they're going to have some kind of influence. And I love that it's always open-ended and unclear fully how much influence they have, but that they kind of are present at different scenes, maybe all the time. Maybe we don't know.
Well, and, I mean, obviously at one point or another, they become kind of the conscience. They're kind of crows, literally peering down on him. But also the metaphor of, well, the problem with fortune-telling. Is it what he was going to do? Do they actually put the ideas in his head, or are they really just, you know, the old, he's playing with the idea of the old Greek chorus,
yes.
right? Are they telling us what is, what's going to be, or are they actually affecting events?
Yeah.
I mean, again, we, from the very beginning, we have the crows, we have kind of a weird ethereal feeling. You mentioned the black and white. I thought it was an interesting choice that it's in 4:3. It's not in cinescope or it's not widescreen.
Yep.
So it feels like an old film strip he probably watched in the 70s when he was in high school.
Yeah.
But we resolve it by having a dude who's wounded, an unnamed sergeant, going, Macbeth and Banquo, one, and then he collapses.
Yeah. Right. Uh-huh.
It also has a production, and again, it's very good, but it's almost staged like a high school play. You have three people standing very awkwardly. Someone comes up, it's like, I'm slain, thud. And he's just like, well, help him. Let's wait for some witches, which is great. But we have to talk about the witch scene.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so crazy.
It's incredible.
My gosh. Yeah, it's this contortionist who's delivering the lines. And the lines do say so adherent to the text, too. Mm-hmm. So you get the trochaic lines, the double, toil and trouble, Okay, yeah, awesome. And so a little bit of poetry here. So the stress on stress, as opposed to, the iambic that we hear all the time, but soft, but light, through yonder wind of breaks. It's normally that heartbeat, that very kind of beautiful heartbeat, ba-bum, ba-bum, that Shakespeare used so often. It's kind of the exact reversal of that. So you get the dot, 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 double, toil and trouble, bum, bum, bum. So you get the stress and then the unstress. And when it's used in that kind of meter and in that way, typically while the iambic pentameter is kind of used in order to replicate a heartbeat, that dun 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 dun, and then along with the rhyming couplets that are being used there, a lot of times it's used in order to kind of like create a trance or in order to kind of enchant.
Oh.
So no mistake why, or no kind of accident why Shakespeare would want to use that trochaic language. It's actually really similar language to in the Odyssey, which we used to teach in eighth grade, but in the moments when Calypso is speaking to Odysseus, also speaking in trochaic, I believe it's rhyming couplets as well. And so you get that kind of like enchantment as Calypso is trying to get Odysseus to stay. And so you get kind of like this enchanting language that's so powerful and used by the witches. So.
And we should, I guess, check, since we're talking about her specifically, her name is Catherine Hunter. She's associated with the Globe Theater. She's won Olivier Awards. I saw her do a version of King Lear where she was King Lear.
Oh, very cool.
And I will say, to that point, we have Lady Macbeth played by Frances McDormand, and both of the women, they kind of androgynize them. Like, even Lady Macbeth has the line, make me a man.
I'm and sex in that
me scene, sex me here.
Yep.
Right, exactly. Like, and they dress her in a very much more kind of, you know, an androgynous way in that scene. And we have this witch who also is not particularly feminine. She's
they're said in the places they have mustaches, I think.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And so I think it was nice to see the depiction of that. Not literally a mustache, but right. The androgynous.
But sure. I mean, because what is interesting is then when they play against other characters in the scene, Lady Macbeth later on, when she is more feminine, or Macbeth himself, where he's very hyper-masculine, mm-hmm. it plays off of them both ways, mm-hmm. which is neat.
Yeah.
It is neat.
But she's also, you can't emphasize enough the contortions, because
yeah. Yeah, right.
when you do it with, you know, less choices made, it is almost a bubbly kind of parody, like Battle of the Toyland.
Yeah.
This is terrifying.
Yeah, for sure.
Unsettling, yeah.
And it's reminiscent of Ingrid Bergman and Swedish neorealism, right? Like the idea that you're playing death in right. some way, right? Like the Seventh Seal is what I'm thinking of. But it's black, white, stark.
Yeah.
And in some ways, again, she's almost an antagonist, but not really, because she's not the one doing anything.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But the camera tricks here are incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think on top of that, later on in the production, she also plays the old man. So the kind of it's the same actress that's playing the old man later. So talking about kind of like blending those lines and blurring those mm-hmm. lines between masculinity and femininity and what that means in the play, but then also quite literally you're visually blurring those lines by then later on having the female playing the old man character. It's doing that same blurring mm-hmm. thing.
Yeah. So the witches say, hey, guess what? You're going to be king.
Yeah.
And he's like, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. Well, and then so Banquo's right there too. So Banquo mm-hmm. gets a foretelling as well mm-hmm. that he will not be king, but his children will be
yes.
here. Someone, his, you know, mm-hmm. his progeny will be. So it's interesting to me to see, especially in the movie production, how Macbeth takes this prediction and runs with it. And
yep.
Banquo is sort of like, hold on. This is, I'm mm-hmm. nervous about this. Do we trust it? What do we do with it? But then, and I was telling Nick this earlier that I really felt like the momentum picked up so early on, and I don't know if I just felt it differently in this particular production or if it's there the whole time in every production, but
yeah.
I felt it. I felt this mm-hmm. like this momentum so early on, dominoes start falling.
Well, and I mean, you know, we think of movies in three acts. This is a five-act play, but this first act just flies by, mm-hmm. and it's really not until we get to the castle. I mean, the rest of this act is essentially Macbeth expects some sort of reward for doing so well,
mm-hmm.
but someone who didn't participate in the battle at all becomes the crown prince.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. And he's left to the side. He feels left out, and that's when he's like, you know, maybe I should be the king. Smash cut. Then we're at the castle.
Yeah,
we're literally mm-hmm. at the castle, and it moves on from there.
Right. So he's Thane of Cawdor, and he's going to welcome the King Duncan to his home.
You're right.
But I just loved the jealousy that the way that it was played. That Denzel played it
uh-huh.
Of Malcolm. It was just great. I also love the character choice for Malcolm, or the actor choice, because he just seems sort of like his whole facial expression seemed very like innocent, or not quite like as aggressive as other.
Yeah, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, and I mean, it's Brendan Gleeson, one of 40 Gleesons in Hollywood. He's in Mad-Eye Moody in the Harry Potter movies. And
right.
For those mm-hmm. of you who like movies,
which I've never seen the movies before.
That's true.
So that I know, maybe I'll be on the podcast for those. I don't
yeah.
know. You
yeah.
do one. Yeah.
We'll definitely do Harry Potter at some point. Which is funny because Dudley is also
yes.
He's the Crown Prince,
mm-hmm.
But when you get Brendan Gleeson, you get a face that just looks like, you know, he's fought hard, he's done a lot of drinking, a lot of, right? I mean, you believe him as a king who's near the end of his life mm-hmm. because he's rugged. That armor looks heavy on him in mm-hmm. a way it doesn't on Banquo or
yeah.
Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say, too, it's black and white, so you can't see the color, but they do a great job of using the color spectrum of grays mm-hmm. in this.
Yes.
The armor's incredible. The gowns are incredible. Mm-hmm. The blood that we'll get to in about
yeah.
30 seconds
yeah.
here is incredible.
Yeah.
But act one ends with them at the castle, him telling his wife, hey, you know, the witches said the craziest thing.
Right.
I should kill Macduff, I should kill Duncan. And she's like, you should definitely do that.
Yeah.
Scene.
And isn't this where we get the first reference to her saying, like, you should be a man?
Yes.
Is this early
yes.
on, mm-hmm. right? And so I love this theme of manliness or being, you know, manly and
mm-hmm.
And how it's kind of used to manipulate people or motivate people in a manipulative way, and then it gets kind of flipped later on, which I can't wait to get to.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
And again, the neat thing about this, it's an hour 45. It's flying
quick.
By.
It's yes. Quick.
And the next scene, it's like, well, let's all go to bed. And Duncan is chilling out, and Macbeth comes in and...
Yeah. What did you think? This is because usually in the play, I think this is done off stage. He just runs out with blood on his hands.
Yeah.
Without the daggers at first, right? Mm-hmm. So what did y'all think of them actually depicting?
Before we get to that, I want to talk about the dagger, because the dagger scene
the
is
dagger.
So incredible.
Yes. Wait, and do we spoil it?
We're just going to get into it. We're just
so
going to get into
cool.
it. Yeah, it's super, super cool. So the way that the dagger scene has, well, I guess we could say like, all right, if you haven't seen it yet, pause it now and then go and watch
word,
it. And then come, right? Isn't that what they do in podcasts?
Right.
Isn't that like a podcast thing?
We know what we're doing. Yeah.
And again, this is a 500-year-old play.
Yeah.
So, spoilers. Duncan does die.
Yeah.
What? Okay.
So the
corridor.
You're walking down this long corridor. And you first you get Denzel's face, and he seems to see the dagger, and it's all the way at the opposite end of the corridor, and it's floating there, just like it is in so many other productions. And this was the first moment where I was saying before, like the edge of the seat moment, was like, what are they going to do with XYZ?
Exactly.
Well, I was totally curious what they were going to do with the dagger scene, and of course, Catherine sitting right next to me as we're watching this, Catherine, who is a ninth grade teacher here and also teaches the play of Macbeth, and we're like getting excited, like, oh, what are they going to do with the dagger scene? And of course, we see this like this little shimmering light there, and then as Denzel continues to go through this soliloquy of, is this a dagger I see before me, and he's getting a little bit closer, and he's a little bit tentative, and he gets a little bit closer, and then the bright shimmering dagger is a little bit brighter, and he's a little bit closer, and then he continues to get a little bit closer, and you can kind of like almost see the decision being made as he's making his way down this long corridor.
He's progressing through his thoughts.
Exactly, until he gets to the end of the corridor and he reaches for the dagger, and it's not a dagger, it's the handle to the door
so cool.
to the bedroom of the king.
Yeah.
And what better representation than like this moment of opportunity, this like dagger of opportunity. And then he just like in one fell swoop clutches the dagger handle and rips the door open. And it's just like this, wow, I have never seen a dagger portrayal like that. And it was fantastic.
Because
it was one of my favorite moments.
When you have us, me too. And because when you have, it's a soliloquy, right?
Mm-hmm.
When you have these things, it's really just us as the person sitting in the seat, getting inside the person's mind. And so to have there also be, even if it's just walking down a corridor, there's something like physically that he's doing was just stunning. And then it's this reveal on reveal.
Right. And because they're playing off this fact that, you know, as they're writing this and as they're shooting this, they know that you're going to be eager to know, like, is this actually going to be a dagger? Is it not?
Yep.
And right when you make that assumption, like, oh, okay, it is a dagger, that's when, once again, just fair is foul and foul is fair. We're flipping everything on its head. You think it's a dagger and it's actually not. And it's one of those moments in Shakespeare too, just like when you're making a decision with the production, when you have a dagger or if you don't have a dagger, just like you're making a decision with things like in Romeo and Juliet in the tomb scene, if there is the ghost of Tybalt there or if there's not, the ghost that appears in Hamlet, are you going to show the ghost? Do you have the other characters reacting to the ghost? And the ghost scene later on is something that in Macbeth, as well as they're making a decision there as well. But you need to make a decision with the dagger, just like you need to make a decision with the ghost in Hamlet. Mm-hmm. And I think that their choice to associate this dagger with the opportunity of opening up that door, that handle, was just so awesome.
Yeah. Well, and there's, as you mentioned, since this is a soliloquy, he has to be doing something. And the actor's thing is, what does he do with his hand? Well, he's actually flicking a blade at the time. Like,
oh, wow.
So he already has the knife. And so the question is whether or not he's going to go through with it.
Yeah.
He's got the weapon in his hand. And over the course of the soliloquy, his expression changes.
Yeah.
Because at first he's very, not dour, but he's unsure.
Mm-hmm.
And then right around when he says, it is the bloody business that informs my knife, he's smiling.
Yeah.
He knows what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And that's great. And the other nice thing about the knife as the door handle, then it's always in the rest of the movie.
Mm. Right.
Because we see that room a bunch, and that handle is in the background a bunch, as though it's his, you know, his guilty conscience.
Yeah, uh-huh.
when it's there, it's not a hallucination anymore. Mm-hmm. It's literally a physical act of something. Mm-hmm. That, yeah. Yeah, it's cool. Mm-hmm.
Cool. And so he enters into the room, yep. King Gungan is sleeping. Uh-huh. And this is, I think, from the productions I've seen, offstage. Mm-hmm. But we get this... He's sitting on Duncan's bed, and Duncan, I think, opens his eyes and sees Macbeth. Mm-hmm. And as he puts his hand over his face, mm-hmm. and then I put my hand up in front of the screen because I didn't want to see it. And I'm not normally very sensitive about those kinds of things, but it just felt, because it's always off stage, it sort of felt like it was wrong. I'm not criticizing it. Yeah. It was an interesting scene. It was shocking to me a little bit, which is crazy because it's such a violent film.
Well, but it allows it to also play with light and dark a lot. Because as he's walking to the corridor has these kind of arches. It's almost like an aqueduct. And as his soliloquy goes further and further, he's less in light and more in shadow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When we get to the room is pretty bright. You know, it has the four-post bed with the curtains drawn, and they're all white. The stabbing is on a red bed, and then the blood pools on the floor, and it is black.
And drips off his fingers. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah.
And we get a kind of – and again, it's all in the lighting because all of a sudden Duncan is dead. But he looks young compared to the very old Macbeth all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. And the whole rest of it, you're going to have lighting on Macbeth looking older and frail and confused. Mm-hmm. And he's going to be bested by a younger man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and not just on Macbeth visually, but also in this production on Lady Macbeth as well. Mm-hmm. Lady Macbeth, you can see kind of the spiraling into the whatever you want to call it, madness, insanity, age. It really does kind of play with that quite a bit. And I thought that also just visually from the start of the play, having a particularly visually older looking characters of Macbeth and Lady Macbeth did some really interesting things as well. It almost made it seem as though, like, this lust for power, it's almost like, well, it's about darn time, you know, like that these are the things that I've been working towards all of my life, and now these are that I've been working towards all these things, and you've been talking so much about how, like, it seems as though things are going so quickly, and I think that it does once kind of that first domino is put into effect. But visually, it's almost like the visual play starts with the witches, but it kind of gives you the impression that this is kind of like a whole, this is a whole lifetime that's been leading up to this, and then it's kind of all happening now in the snap of a finger.
Yeah, and that's where this play feels the most different from Hamlet, because Hamlet is always a younger man who is impulsive, and it's all crumbling down around him, and, you know, essentially he brings around his own end very quickly. For this, you do, and the movie sets it up, but the play sets it up too. He was passed over by a younger person, even though he should have all the glory. Yep. Mm-hmm. He's a man who is frustrated in this.
But I also like too that, you know, we can ask this question. I don't know that we have an answer, but how much is he influenced by being told by the witches that he will be king? Mm-hmm. So I love that supernatural element that I think leaves us wondering what kind of guy was he, what's really happened before this in order for us to be set up for such a quickly dissolving person.
Yeah.
So he goes in and he kills Duncan. We get that great scene. I think there's also so much beautiful language in the play of white, the colors white and red, and the contrast between those two. Mm-hmm. And so to have the black and white showcases that white, as you said, with the light so beautifully. And then we get the great scene. He goes back and talks to his wife, and he has blood on his hands, right? Literally, right? I just, you know, these interactions, the push and pull of the two of them is, I never get tired of these scenes where it's just the two of them, because where one is not sure, the other one steps right in and is sure about what to do next or how to proceed.
Well, then, we killed one guy. We got to kill everyone. Right. He kills the guards. And then it tumbles down.
Yep.
And she practically slaps him and goes, don't be a coward here. We got to keep going. I mean, because there's even the tears running down his face. Because it's Denzel, and he can act like crazy.
Right. Yeah.
And then he kills the guards, and then, like, is totally on display afterwards. And looking at Lady Macbeth's face, she's like, you did what? What were you thinking? And, of course, he's kind of like... He's performing now. Now he needs to. They're bought in on this, and so he delivers kind of like his excuse for why it is that he did that. Of course, but it's looking at her face, and she's like, where are you going with this, bud? What's the end game here, you know?
And is this the scene where she faints to, like, distract?
Yes.
Which is such a kind of iconic moment, I think, for the play. It wasn't, like, spectacular, but I think it's an important plot point that, you know, the two of them continue to work together to manipulate people and what people see and what they don't see and what they believe.
And what another powerful manipulation of femininity and masculinity, yep, to her, where it's, oh, the frail,
yep,
the frail. And this is fresh off of the scene where she is essentially, like, stormed out of the room in order to, like, fix the mess that he's made in a lot of ways. And now, so visually, the audience knows that this is anything but the frailty of woman. This is an empowering and manipulative, mm-hmm, kind of like the fainting that's taking place.
Remind me, if we can get back to it, we're just going back a little bit for when Lady Macbeth has that scene where before Macbeth returns and before the royalty come to their house, where she's saying, "Unsex me here."
Mm-hmm.
That takes place in the film on her bed, or partially in her bedroom?
In her bedroom. As she says the thing, halfway through the soliloquy, she lies down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the way we did it in the stage production I was in is the witches sort of entered into the background and were sort of around her as she was doing that. Mm-hmm. But I just think, again, this question about how present the witches are, and as we've talked about, like, the fact that they can shapeshift into animals, mm-hmm, that are commonly seen in, yeah, everyday life is just fascinating. So, mm-hmm, I just, Lady Macbeth, and this portrayal of her was amazing.
Yeah. Send the act. Yeah. Duncan's sons flee to, mm-hmm, England and Ireland. And Macbeth is king at the end of Act 2, so he's doing pretty good.
Yeah.
But
we should end here, right? I mean, that's all he wanted was just to be king. We're good, right?
Yeah. Banquo is like, hey, there was more to that prophecy.
Yeah.
And he's always suspicious of Macbeth, effectively, is how it ends. But Macbeth is like, well, I gotta kill Banquo now because he suspects too much.
Yeah.
And Act 3 is like, let's have a dinner scene.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Which is not at all suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. But his, Banquo's son is there. He has to be killed. And, like, there's literally these two merry murderers that just know Macbeth that are going to just go around and start slaughtering folks, mm-hmm, which is, kind of how it goes. Macbeth hires two goons to have him murdered.
Mm-hmm.
There's then a third murderer who checks to make sure the job is done.
Yeah. Prior to that, though, there's Banquo's soliloquy, and the way that it's visually shot is it's in, like, this crazy tall, like I don't even know how to describe, like, cathedral-esque room, and, like, there's light that's coming peering down. But if you look at, like, the actual camera shot, it's actually at a Dutch angle. It's actually, like, a little, mm-hmm, bit askew, which typically is kind of an indication that, like, something's a little bit off here, which is so representative of what Banquo is kind of talking about in that soliloquy as well. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those really cool moments where the cinematography kind of reflects what it is that's going on with the text there as Banquo is delivering his soliloquy. I thought it was really cool.
Well, and again, how many soliloquies are given in, like, almost high school light? Like, they're in, mm-hmm, front of, they're lit, everything behind them is dark. Mm-hmm. There's weird lighting coming in, but it's so masterfully done.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm, I want to know how big these sets were, because sometimes you have a character walk in who's this big and the shadow stretches. It's remarkably done.
Mm-hmm.
But again, at this rate, we're going to do the whole play in real time. Yeah. This is awesome. Essentially,
the murderer's killed.
Yeah, well, everyone's killed.
Yeah.
Let's just do that. Banquo is murdered. His son is murdered. We, mm-hmm, have this.
That Banquo's son is murdered? Fleance.
Yes, he's not. I'm getting confused.
No, I'm not trying to. Excuse me. I just want to make sure I understand.
Fleance
everyone's murdered. Fleance escapes
the murder. Yes.
I was confused by this in the film. There's a scene with, like, an old man. I guess it's now the witch.
Which was the same. I believe it's the same.
Yeah.
That if
yeah,
IMDb as I was watching it is accurate, which I'm assuming that it is. It's the same. It's the same actress that plays the witches from before.
That's right.
So I just never tire of the story surprising me.
Uh-huh.
I know what's going to happen. I know every plot point, but I still just love following through with these surprises. So so the murderers are supposed to kill Banquo and Fleance, but Fleance, the one thing, right? It's still, the prediction still holds true from the witches with Fleance escaping.
Right. Fly, Fleance, fly. Right.
Yeah. I think
it's very Tolkien.
Yeah.
But Macbeth, that's when we see the witches the second time.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. When actually we know it's the witches. The witches get scolded kind of for interfering. Mm-hmm. They're not really interfering. At least that's what they say. But this is where we get warned of the fifth act, which is Macduff's a-coming.
Ugh. Mm-hmm. So good.
It is.
It's so good. I'm curious, and maybe y'all can fill in some gaps of knowledge here, but I'm fascinated by what Shakespeare would have understood about demons and evil forces, and you know, that I think is what makes the play kind of great to watch around Halloween. But I struggle with how to make sense of what it was for them or how it can still exist now. One of the big differences I would say between Breaking Bad and Macbeth, because I think there's so many similarities. I hope it's okay that I'm bringing it up.
No, absolutely.
I love the connection.
I love the connection.
But I think is, you know, there's actual witches who are there sort of, and evil forces. Whereas now, I think we would quickly sort of say like, well, that's just power hungry. That's just, you know, a desire for, to control people or whatever. That's a psychological kind of thing.
Yeah.
But here we've got actual embodied physical evil.
Well, you're our English expert, but I mean, I would say the idea of having what here they're shapeshifters, which is not necessarily in the play, depending on how you interpret it. But the idea of having a soothsayer or a fortune teller as part of the royal court is, I mean, it's common. And, I mean, Reagan had fortune tellers in the White House in the 80s.
Yeah.
So let's not go crazy. But, like, so I would imagine that the idea that there was some link to the supernatural would have been there. But it also makes it almost like a fable as well, right? Like, it allows there to be morality because, I mean, and who knows, because it's Shakespeare, and some people don't even think he's real because they're stupid. But, I mean, this, if I recall correctly from my order of things, this is written in the, like, shadow of the gunpowder plot. So there was this real idea that someone could bring down the government with an explosion. And so he's taking this stuff also very seriously.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of humor in this one.
No.
Which there is even in Hamlet. Like, this is a very bleak poem comparatively, which makes it move, but it makes it very dark.
I guess the only comedic thing is the porter. And so the porter scene comes...
Which they did include. They don't always, but they did.
And it wasn't very long. I feel like they cut some of it, but it was still there. And it, you know, I've seen it really, like, slapsticky.
Yeah.
You know, this was not that.
No.
But it does mention equivocation, which... I am like, now I can't stop thinking about equivocation.
Yeah.
So equivocation, the idea that you like conceal certain information, you don't fully say or answer a question someone asks you, you sort of answer it in a way that only reveals certain things. And I can't stop thinking about how that touches so many of the characters, so many of the interactions that they have together, the witches, Macbeth, Lady Macbeth, I mean, just so many of the characters. I just think it's fascinating that it's sort of hidden and embedded in this, what could be considered like just a comedic relief. We need a drunk porter who's talking about alcohol and sex and, you know, but no, there's some really cool stuff that's embedded in there too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, in this production, played by the great Stephen Root, who is also this year in Book of Boba Fett, and the guy who loses his stapler in Office Space.
I don't think I realized that.
He's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, he comes in and he's playing it kind of drunk, but he's also kind of knows a lot. He's like really ribbing people, and you get the feeling that everyone involved has no time for his nonsense.
Yeah.
And that's, again, like you said, I can understand why you'd skip the scene, but here it really ties together how everyone's on like a knife's edge, which is perfect. I know we're flying through here, guys, but this play,
we'll never
finish.
Right.
Act four. Hey, look at that. Macduff's a coming. And they warn them that there's he is safe until Birnam Wood comes to the hill. And he's like, well, that makes no sense. Thanks, ladies.
Perfect.
Yeah.
And no man of woman born will harm Macbeth.
Yes.
That's the other one. So what a great, I mean, I just, equivocation, right?
And of course we in the audience, and this is for all versions of the play that you're watching. I mean, you know that you're watching the tragedy of Macbeth. So there's something a little bit tragic in the fact that like Macbeth, doesn't even seem, like, concerned at all, despite the fact that, like, the entire world around him is crumbling down. He's like, oh, sweet, cool. No, I'm totally fine. Like he just buys in, and I don't know if it's just that blind optimism or what it is, but he's like, no, listen, I'm fine. there's no way that there's going to be anybody that's going to be able to kill me, since the person needs to be born of woman. So I'm totally fine, like, and totally not concerned with it. And there's something a little bit tragic about that too,
yeah.
Where we in the audience are waiting for that shoe to drop, where it's like, okay, well, we know we're watching the tragedy of Macbeth. We know you're going down, and it becomes such a tragic kind of like entirety of the play as you're watching this, and you're like, oh gosh, buddy, like, why are you buying so much into these witches? Like, let's be a little bit more hesitant, like Banquo,
yes.
and kind of like not quite buy in as much, you know, let's be a little bit more hesitant, you know?
We also have to put down the fact that he's now kind of comfortable with everything, which is getting weirder and weirder,
yeah,
right? Uh-huh. Like, which you alluded to, but like, his first murder really bothered him. The rest, not so much.
Right.
We're introduced to the witches here as sitting up in the rafters.
Yeah.
And then, like, a talking baby's head is telling
right.
him.
Right.
And this is weird, but he's just like, but what should I do?
Yeah.
Not really, like, he's not doing anything other than processing information, which you shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
This is weird.
Yeah.
And they do a really good job of raising the absurdity.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the Steve Martin rule. The if you're going to make it absurd, the first thing has to be the most absurd. Her as the witch at the very beginning.
Absurd.
You get everything.
Yeah. Right.
But here, he's looking up, he's looking down, he's looking up, because they're surrounding him with this nonsense.
Right.
Yeah.
And they just keep saying, beware. And you're just, right? Like, it's so well done.
Right.
And the play, even reading it off the page, when they're repeating, beware of this, beware of that, it has a rhythm to it, and he's like, I got this.
Yeah.
He's in control of nothing.
Right. Nothing.
Absolutely.
Nothing. And yet believes he is in control of everything.
Yeah. It's his flaw.
Right.
Yeah.
There's too many casts. We better start killing them off.
Are we to Macduff's family now?
Well, why not? We're near the end. We can get to the end of the fourth and beginning of the fifth, where everyone starts to die.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a dance scene. Important witch dance sequence.
Oh my gosh, excuse me. How could I? Yeah, we can't skip this. Because, you know, we talked about the dagger, but there's also beautiful choices here. So, right, so we know there's a ghost. And also, I am curious, either on mic or off, if either of you believe in ghosts, because I think it's a great question that the play, and I think just that being haunted by someone, by your actions, by something you've done, is so resonant with me. And keeps me coming back to the play. So there's this dinner scene.
Right. And, I mean, what happens is he's like, well, we just have to kill Macduff. That'll solve everything.
Yeah.
Hey, and we have the scene where everyone's at home and there's a peaceful, oh no, everything goes horribly wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But of course, Macduff gets away.
Mm-hmm.
They just slaughtered the wife and child in what looks like a lovely suburban house.
Yeah.
So that tips off Macduff that I should go get Macbeth.
Right.
Who otherwise would not have entered the movie, I guess,
right.
The play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm like, just processing and just back with the ghost presentation with the ravens, the birds kind of like come in and they're he's like all fluttered around and I know I keep talking about like the moments that like I as the viewer keeping like, okay, what are they gonna do with this? What are they gonna do with this? What are they gonna do with this? Whether they show the ghost or not, because it's we know Macbeth sees the ghost. So it's always the question of, well, does anybody else see the ghost? Because if nobody else sees the ghost, then maybe Macbeth is going crazy. Kind of similar to the ghost in Hamlet.
Right.
So if nobody else sees this ghost, like how are we going to explain the fact that Macbeth is either A, going crazy, or B, he's not going crazy, you know? And so much of that can be determined by the representation of the ghost.
Right.
And so the fact that they were able to kind of, like, play it off with the ravens that were kind of, like, in and fluttering around, and then it go... you know, flies out the window, right?
Oh, yeah.
And it's one of those things where it's like, okay, well, so that's how we explained it. But at the same time, this ghost then becomes this representation of the fates. It becomes this representation of the witches. And I'm reminded of like the contortionist still in the beginning, and how like bird-like almost that is. Mm-hmm. And then these ravens that are just kind of like hauntingly around, just as you're talking about the ghosts, these ravens that are hauntingly surrounding and kind of like overwatching this story as it's taking place, almost as though they're kind of like lurking and waiting, you know. And it's this moment where the witches and this aspect of the supernatural can kind of like embed itself in the play. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really cool that they kind of like played it off in that way, and in some way kind of like wove together the witches and the fates and the raven, and all at the same time explained, okay, so this is why it is that he's acting the way that he is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I'll also say the undulation and stuff also reminds me of water, and there's so much water in the sea. Like, again, uh-huh. I mean, Lady Macbeth having her breakdown out damn mm-hmm. spot, and she's
at the pool.
I mean, his second visit with the witches, when they say beware Macduff, he's also looking into a pool.
In the beginning reflection when we first meet the witches.
Turning one witch into three, right?
Yeah, you got the one and then the reflection. The
and, it, right. and they're like rippling. And, yeah. I mean, again, it's excellent imagery as we kind of watch. You want to spoil the ending?
So Banquo loses his, no, Macduff loses his family.
Yeah.
And then finds out that we've got this character, and I didn't realize until I was talking to Catherine that this same actor who plays both Ross and, who's the other character? He plays these two different characters, which again is Lennox. Yes.
Lennox.
And so, you know, we've got these smaller characters that function to like reveal things and communicate things throughout the play as it's traditionally on stage.
Yeah.
But then this character in the film is kind of collapsed into one and ends up looking like a puppet master behind the scenes of so much of the drama that's happening, which I think is really cool. Again, almost like a connection to like Game of Thrones, when you've got characters who are doing things behind
the
scenes.
Like Littlefinger, yeah.
So I think that's really fascinating. His clothes are also very strange. I wasn't really sure what to make of that.
Uh-huh.
I wasn't sure if that was a Shakespeare thing. So we get this revelation that Macduff and all of his children and wife are killed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I thought the delivery of that speech was stunning.
Mm-hmm.
To really hear the grief. And also we get, you know, that throughout the whole play, Lady Macbeth is saying, Macbeth, be a man. And Macbeth's like, all right, I'll be a man. I'll do all these terrible things. And then we get this one scene where, I believe it's, a Malcolm who says, all right, Macduff, be a man.
Yeah.
Take this knowledge. And he says something like, I am going to be a man. I'm going to grieve. Give me a minute.
Flipping
that on its head is such a great, a subversive moment.
Yeah.
So I loved that in the midst of all the tragedy. We get like a human moment.
Yeah.
Where we've got a contrast to Macbeth, who's like not living in what we see as reality and seeing all these terrible things.
Well, I mean, literally next, we have Lady Macbeth out damn spot.
Yep.
And she's losing her mind at this point. I do like how they figured out how to have people listen to her. Like, she's essentially in a dressing gown. Like, she's in her PJs, her hair's everywhere, and she's screaming at the top of her lungs in the garden. And people are like, oh, she's crazy.
Yeah.
Looking out at her, which is fantastic.
I love the use of sleepwalking in the play. I think the idea of not being able to sleep and being like unrested.
Yeah.
I don't know if y'all talk or walk in your sleep. I do. And it is, it's terrible because I don't know, you know, I'll wake up, someone will wake me up in the middle of it and I feel embarrassed that I don't know what I did or said. I mean, so I just think as a use in the play, it's such so stunning to get inside her mind where, because she's so, what's this great line about, where they're talking about showing certain things and then deceiving other people. False heart doth know. What's that one? False face doth hide. What false heart doth?
I can't remember the line.
Doth know. There's this great line in the play that someone who's listening to this is like screaming at me and like, get it right. But it is revelatory of the falseness. And so we get her walking around just completely not rested, not at peace.
Right.
Mm-hmm. No, it's true. And we are also entering the high fantasy of them literally moving the woods.
Yes.
Right?
Which they did so well in the film, I thought.
Yeah.
You know, I agree. But, like, this is also you bringing that line up with Malcolm and Macduff about give me a moment, we have to figure this out, is completely opposed by Macbeth getting actual advice. There's 10,000 people out there from Satan, Seton, or whatever his name is.
Mm.
And he completely ignores him. He's getting real advice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at this point, he's also completely broken with reality,
mm-hmm.
Which is great. And as he looks out, all we get are like scenes of his own demise.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's the thing that I think, and it was a couple of days ago that I was watching it, so I don't remember exactly, but I remember talking with Catherine, and one of the moments that we were talking about that is kind of like an important moment that they did rely on the witches and rely on the fates is that moment with the fulfillment of the walking trees, right? That it's one of the reasons why Macbeth thinks that he's safe.
Mm.
And yet in this version, you never quite get that moment of like recognition, like as these trees are walking forward. Now, granted, he's so bought into this prophecy that he, I'm sure, would be like, oh, I'll be fine anyways. As long as nobody is not born of woman, I'm still going to be okay. But you still, even in this version, you still lack that moment of recognition. And that was one thing that Catherine was talking about too, was that we lack that moment of recognition when Macbeth actually sees like those trees walking forward. I think part of what ends up happening there is you never quite get that like light switch moment, and Macbeth in this version never has it. He never really realizes it.
Right. And but I guess I also, one of the things I love about it is he as a character not at that point in his life even able to be like experience redemption and experience reality. His wife killed herself.
Right.
Or Catherine even said it was implied in the film that she was killed.
Yeah.
And he sort of like. You don't get the grief human grief you would get if your wife is dead.
Yeah.
Well, the line is, I think, is something like, "What was that sound?"
Yes.
I don't recognize.
Yes.
And then he goes, the women are screaming, and he goes, "Huh? Never would have recognized that noise." And he looks down the stairwell, and she's just dead.
Just
and
there. Right.
And tomorrow.
Yes.
But no, it's interesting because it depends on how you want to interpret whatever, but. There's no time for him to even think about anything.
Yeah.
Because that poor kid comes back, told you the woods are moving.
Right.
Yeah. And he practically kills the kid on the spot.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So,
we get a final kind of meetup between Macduff and Macbeth.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then we've got some great sword fighting, which really hasn't been an element until this point in the film, at least.
And one thing that I had written down just in my notes as I was watching it, too, is that the portrayal by Denzel in that sword fighting moment, I think he even takes a sword to the face and he's unscathed by it, and it's just a representation of how like untouchable he feels.
He's delusional, right?
He's so delusional about it, you can see kind of like even in just his movements that he is so supremely confident, mm-hmm. and the line has not yet come of being untimely ripped, so the kind of his mortality, he has not at any point kind of like forced to recognize that mortality, and kind of never really does. Like he kind of holds on to that false confidence all the way through his death.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and just one more filmmaking thing. There's two sword fights at the end.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
the one with Squidward or Sillard or whatever his name is, which is filmed because Macbeth is going to win it.
Uh-huh.
It is completely in dark, and he is in light.
Uh-huh.
So they have the two actors fighting, and it's well lit from behind them, so you can see them. But the whole scenery is dark. It's mm-hmm. it's a brutal death. But then the lighting with the final fight is completely in light.
Mm.
And as Macbeth is being backed up down this walkway, it's getting narrower as though his whole...
I love that.
And the line, of course, this is where the twist is, that he goes, "I can't be killed by anyone born of woman." And he was essentially birthed by Caesarian.
Yes.
But like the claustrophobia of the scene, the fog comes back in.
I loved that it's in a hallway because we're getting it adds this tension to where they can't go anywhere. It's just the two of them.
And it's almost reminiscent of that corridor from before as well, that he was making his way down at the moment that kind of started all of this, that moment of opportunity. And now all of this is, it's almost kind of like on a bridge, and now you're it's, I think that calling it kind of like that claustrophobic moment is definitely very accurate. And then he loses his crown. And I thought that visually, that was like, that's the first moment where he starts to, where you can see kind of like a little bit of shock come over his face, because it's almost like a little bit of a chink in the armor. And then he, like, the way that Macbeth dies, I think is so very interesting, that he dies not really at knife point necessarily, but he dies as he's reaching for the crown. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's so powerful to me, that it's a moment where he is reaching for kind of like this symbol of this power that he was lusting after. And not to get too kind of like symbolic and analytical with it, but that notion of the hamartia, that tragic flaw that brings down the character. And of course, Romeo has his rashness, and Hamlet has his pause, and famously Caesar has his hubris. And what I've always taken as the hamartia, that tragic flaw of Macbeth, is that lust for power.
Oh, yeah.
And so he dies as a direct impact of that moment where he is reaching for that symbol of that power. He's reaching for that crown, and that's the moment that he dies, not on the aggression, but in this moment where he's that lust for power, that reaching for power, quite literally directly leads to his death.
And to what Betsy said earlier, he is so confident he literally turns his back on someone with a sword in his hand.
Yeah.
Right? Like, and what we have at the end is literally the most graphic scene. Like, his head is physically cut off.
Yes.
And then re-enter Ross with a head in one hand and a crown in the other.
And again, Ross, who's sort of been orchestrating things behind the scenes, to have him also bring the head back and the crown is like, it's just perfect.
He also has that moment right before, it's kind of like in that sleepwalk. I believe Lady Macbeth is like in the midst of that sleepwalking. And it's like the castle is being sacked at the moment.
Right.
And yet Lady Macbeth is still kind of like in the midst of that sleepwalking. And I think that it's the actor who plays Lennox / kind of like a couple of different characters, kind of like gives, it's a very kind of like skewed look, and he looks kind of like almost out of the corner of his eye, and then very slowly starts walking up the steps towards Lady Macbeth, almost implying kind of like that conspiracy aspect of like, was Lady Macbeth murdered, you know? And yet he's still kind of this puppet master behind the scenes who's kind of pulling the strings all along.
Well, and how does the play end? Well, at least the movie version end. He gives the crown. He's the one who says, all hail King of Scotland. And then he's the one with Fleance at the end.
Yeah.
Right? He pays off the witch or whoever, the old man.
Right.
And then rides off into the distance with the kid. And he's going to be fine.
Yeah.
he played the game exactly right.
He did.
And then crow cut to credit. I've never seen the crows at credit before.
Yeah.
But I guess what we should do is do it in two steps. First, does this play belong as part of what we're doing? And then would you recommend the movie? So we'll start with you.
Yeah, I definitely think that for all of the aspects of kind of visually, and it almost like belongs in a cinematography class. Just with all of the way that the lighting is being used. And I think that it's in some ways like what I was talking about with the crown and the hamartia. I think that it's kind of heavy handed in some ways, but in some ways that can be good to teach with. That can be good to, like, you have a very, very definite struggle with good and evil and the light and the dark, and it's just played out in front of you visually. And I think for that reason, both the text, which I think is still to talk about a lust for power, I think is a pretty universal and human, a human emotion and a human reaction. Certainly not to the point of murder, but it's definitely something that we can all relate to.
Yeah.
But then I think that visually, in terms of the way that it was shot, I think that it can be used to teach in some ways. And I think that's part of what makes it not only a good text, but also I think belongs kind of like in the teaching vernacular, so to speak.
Excellent. Does he?
Yeah, I continue to revisit the play, I think, because it's so satisfying to me that there are consequences to actions, you know?
Yeah.
I think early on when, right after he comes back from killing King Duncan, he says he can't complete the prayers, like the night prayers.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
You know, I'm a theology teacher, so I pay attention to those things maybe more than other people, but I really find it satisfying to watch and take in stories where there are we see consequences to actions. Now, I'm not talking about, like, I don't love, like, a morality play, but that's what makes this so fascinating, is that it's not preaching at us about how to be a good person,
right.
But it's showing that when you start to make choices like Macbeth does, you start to unravel.
If I'm not mistaken, the moment where he's saying, like, I couldn't say amen. Mm-hmm. Why couldn't I say amen?
Right.
It's like this gut-wrenching moment. It's very like emotional and very human. And I think that that's what leads to that catharsis too, right? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's what these tragedies are trying to do, is to get that, trying to get that emotional purge. And I think that it's done in this play because when you have such elevated characters as kings and princes and thanes, and it can be difficult, I think, sometimes for that to be like an achievable catharsis. But mm-hmm. I think that when you have such a human character like you do with Macbeth, I think that it becomes very attainable and very relatable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I'll just end it with saying, yes, you guys, I agree. I will say too, as far as this production goes, it's interesting how minimalistic it is.
Yeah.
You know, I in the 90s we had a lot of Kenneth Branagh productions.
Oh, yeah.
And those are so indulgent.
The Hamlet. Right? The Hamlet of Kenneth Branagh.
Which is like 4.5 hours. And it's beautiful, but nothing simple about it. Even the Olivier version is pretty indulgent. The Roman Polanski version is excellent, but it's also very big and over the top. So the minimalism here is, I think, not only effective, but it adds to the feeling of madness. It feels like vertigo or something.
Oh, for sure.
Now, overall, I'd say the play obviously should – it's been 500 years, guys. I will add nothing to that discourse. but I will say it's easily understandable.
Yeah.
And in a way that a lot of them aren't. Mm-hmm. Like, this movie, I didn't need to have the text in front of me, and I understood it, and you get the emotions, and it's on the actors' faces. But the play also, it's sub 2 hours, or if it's the long version, it's 2:15.
Yeah.
That's a breeze, guys. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You should just pick it up, give it a shot, because it's easy to understand, but you won't feel bored by it.
Right.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for reviewing.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. We had someone read before the monologue of Macbeth. I don't know who did it because I have three people who said they would do it. They haven't done it yet. But that sample was from a student here.
Oh, fine.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Which one is it?
We're doing his Whether I'm Not a Good or Murdered.
Duncan.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
We're doing that monologue. But we're going to try to incorporate a reading selection for each book we're doing from now on.
Oh, cool.
So if you like that, let us know. Otherwise, I'll stop it. But in the meantime, we appreciate you listening, subscribing. And wherever you get it, please review us. Give us 5 stars. Thanks, guys.
Myopia Movies is produced by Nick Hoffman and Daniel Settis. It is hosted by Nick Hoffman and Daniel Settis. Mission Briefing is hosted by John Copsey. Podcasts are edited by Daniel Settis, and Patreon is edited by Nick Hoffman. Our engineer is Nick Hoffman. The theme song is Sir Shinny by Kevin MacLeod from incomtech.com. Licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.